Hello and welcome to this series of podcasts by Kilkenny Library Services in association with the Decade of Centenaries. My name is Owen Swinton Welsh, and in these bite-sized podcasts, we'll be taking up where we left off last year, this time focusing on that fateful year in Irish history, 1921, highlighting the key events that took place in County Kilkenny. Of course, this covers the final 6.5 months of the War of Independence and then the truce period in County Kilkenny. It should be noted that the final 6 months of the conflict was the deadliest period of the 2.5 year war. 16 of the 20 people who died in County Kilkenny as a direct result of the conflict died during the final 6 months. In other words, that's 80% of the fatalities in the final half year. And that's not including the two Crown Force personnel who died in Monaghan, County Tipperary, which was part of the 7th Kilkenny Battalion headquartered in Callan. Now, in today's podcast, I'll be taking a look at the Friary Street ambush, which took place on Monday morning, the 21st of February, 1921. It was the only major ambush that took place in Kilkenny City during the War of Independence. It turned out to be a disaster for the local IRA men, along with one civilian who really was in the wrong place at the wrong time. The 1st Kilkenny IRA Battalion, based in and around Kilkenny City, were the ones who planned the ambush. The 1st Battalion was led by Tim Hennessy, originally from Three Castles, but who was working and living in Inishnag in the shop and pub there. People will know Sheridan's of Inishnag today. That's where he was working. Now, it is believed that pressure had come down from IRA GHQ in Dublin, led of course by Michael Collins and Richard Mulcahy, that some form of assault was required in Kilkenny City. They felt the city up to that point had been too quiet and something needed to occur. The Crown Forces would often say in their reports that Kilkenny was a loyal or loyalist city, which did not impress many of the locals, as you can imagine. In addition, the IRA GHQ were aware that altercations or ambushes in the cities and towns usually garnered more media attention. The availability of local journalists who were always close on hand, the easy access to the telephone and telegraph networks in a town, along with all the eyewitnesses that were around, often gave even the smallest skirmishes in an urban setting the aura of a great battle. In contrast, ambushes that took place in remote rural areas, successful or otherwise, never seemed to get the same attention, with some notable exceptions. In the propaganda wars that were being fought between the British and Irish sides in parallel to the military conflict, getting your message out was important. In January 1921, George O'Dwyer of Coon near Castlecomer was made OC, that's Officer Commanding, of the entire Kilkenny IRA Brigade, following the arrests of Tom Tracy and then subsequently Peter DeLucri, the previous OCs, during the previous 2 months. O'Dwyer had been to Dublin to meet with IRA GHQ. He arranged a meeting then with Tim Hennessy at the home of Patrick Bryan on Kieran Street in Kilkenny. Hennessy said that O'Dwyer was very annoyed at the lacklustre position of the IRA in Kilkenny. He thus gave Hennessy free rein to initiate an offensive. Hennessy had already been thinking of attacking a convoy of British troops that travelled daily through the city. This gave him the go-ahead to put his plans into action. Every morning at around 9 o'clock, 7 or 8 soldiers from the 1st Devonshire Regiment transported food supply rations on a horse and cart from Kilkenny Military Barracks to Kilkenny Jail, or as it was officially known then, His Majesty's Prison, which was on the other side of town, of course. Kilkenny Barracks is still there, now known as James Stephens Barracks, where the 3rd Irish Infantry Battalion are based, known as the Bloods. The jail, on the other hand, no longer exists and was completely knocked down in the 1950s. It was on St. Rioch Street at the end of Walken Street and Gale Road, hence where that latter name comes from. The estates of St. Francis's Terrace and Rioch Court are today in the location of where the prison grounds were. Now back to the ambush plan. And maybe you can visualise this route if you know Kilkenny. Crown Forces convoy went by foot from the barracks up John Street, over John's Bridge, up Rose Inn Street, it then turned right onto High Street and then took a left onto Friary Street, which of course people will know is the first left after the Book Centre. From here it went the short distance to the jail. The military convoy always followed the same routine and formation. Two soldiers marched out in front, There was a gap of about 50 yards, which is about 46 meters for those of you using the metric system. Then there was 3 to 4 soldiers in the middle with the cart of rations. That is one driving the cart and 2 or 3 marching directly behind us. And finally, there were 2 soldiers back a distance of about 50 yards coming up the rear. Most notably from the IRA point of view, the plan for this ambush in Kilkenny City was to involve no shooting. Instead, the soldiers would be attacked and disarmed simultaneously at different positions along the length of Friary Street. The IRA men would therefore be spaced out along the street just as the soldiers in the convoy would be. The IRA would also outnumber the soldiers 2 to 1, so that's about 16 men altogether in the ambush party. Although the attacking IRA would carry guns, the logic for this no-shoot policy could have been a moralistic one, but is more likely to have been an effort to save the inhabitants of Kilkenny City suffering the same fate as parts of Cork City did just 2 months previously, where the city centre was burned to the ground by auxiliaries following the death of a British soldier in an ambush. Keeping the Kilkenny public on side was very important. Hence, the overall goal of the ambush was to capture at least 7 much-needed rifles, along with ammunition and perhaps even revolvers, which of course were all scarce in the Kilkenny IRA, without anyone having to lose their lives. So if you can imagine that layout of the soldiers taking up the length of Friary Street, you can envision the plan of the IRA men. And remember, Friary Street has changed very, very little in the last 100 years, so it's even better to take a stroll up it. Or if you're not living close by, maybe look it up on Google Maps and Street View to visualise the plan and the strategy and how it was all intended to work. Another key aspect of the plan was that only men from the rural companies of the 1st Battalion based outside the city were to be chosen for the attacking party. This was to avoid the problem of anyone being identified. This meant Tim Hennessy himself would not be involved in the attack as he was well known to the authorities. Indeed, he had recently suffered a vicious beating at the hands of the auxiliaries when they visited his premises in Inishnag, a beating he was still recovering from. Instead, Jim O'Brien, the captain of the Garnamon Newtown IRA companies near Kells, would lead the attack. Along with the Kells company, men from the Bennett its Bridge and Treecastle's companies would also participate. In the days leading up to the ambush, the IRA party with Tim Hennessy in charge practiced the proposed ambush plan at Shine Hill on the Callan Road. When the morning of the ambush finally came around, that's the 21st of February 1921, the attacking party made their way to Kilkenny on bicycles. The Treecastle's men parked their bikes at the railings of St Mary's Cathedral and then said a quick prayer inside while they waited for the air to come. Kells and Bennett's Bridge contingent parked their bikes at the bottling store yard near the country end of Friary Street. A horse and cart was also waiting there to pick up any guns that were to be taken from the soldiers that day. Then at 9 a.m. all the men made their way to their allotted positions along Friary Street. A long half hour eventually passed as they waited for the patrol to come. Then at 9:30 a.m. the first part of the convoy could be seen turning from High Street onto the narrow Friary Street. The attack was to begin simultaneously when Jim O'Brien blew his whistle. He along with the Kells crew would attack the centre of the convoy when the cart was directly outside Gargan's monumental works in the middle of Friary Street, which of course is still there today, would you believe it? At that point, the top of the convoy would be around where Doherty's pub is today, then known as Hackett's pub, which is near the New Street side of Friary Street. The 2 soldiers there would be attacked by the Bennett's Bridge contingent. The final 2 soldiers at the rear would be disarmed near the Friary Church entrance by the Treecastle's contingent. However, Jim O'Brien never got to blow his whistle that day. Disaster struck. The 2 rear soldiers were closer to the middle of the convoy than they should have been. Thomas Hennessy, the leader of the 4 Treecastle's men there that day, quickly decided that himself and Michael Darmody would take the 2 soldiers between them and that the other 2 Treecastle men, that being Dick McAvoy and Ned Dunn, should wait around the Friary Church at Pennyfedder Lane and cover them. However, within seconds, the plan had all fallen apart. Leaving their positions from Garden Row, a laneway opposite the Friary Gate, Hennessy and Darmody pulled their revolvers on the 2 soldiers from behind, ordering them to hands up. The soldiers, who were Private Harry Hawthorne and Private Stanley Arthur Gay, froze. Hennessy tried to swing Horton to the ground by grabbing him by the waist. Just then, Gay grabbed the barrel of Darmody's revolver and pushed it away. Darmody then grabbed the private's rifle, which included a dangerous fixed bayonet, at the same time hitting him over the head with the handle of his revolver, knocking the soldier to the ground and knocking his steel helmet from his head. Darmody was a very strong and well-built fellow from farming stock. In the meantime, a woman standing at her doorway on Friary Street started screaming when she saw the guns and what was happening. She shouted, "Soldiers, soldiers, you are being attacked." This alerted the rest of the military convoy to what was happening directly behind them. They had not yet got as far as Gargan Stonecutter's yard, hence no whistle from the IRA. Lance Corporal Ernest Higgins and Private Harley Turner turned around to see their comrades wrestling with Hennessy and Darmody just where Pennyfeather Lane meets Friary Street. They ran to their assistance, taking shelter in the doorways either side of the street. Both men then took aim. When they got a clear shot, they both fired. Private Gay described what happened just at those moments. "The rifle fell out of my hand and he," that's Darmody, "picked it up and swinging it by the barrel over his shoulder was just about to strike me with the butt of end of the rifle. At that moment I heard a shot fired and my assailant fell on his face. Immediately after my assailant had been shot, I heard another shot fired and Private Hawthorne's assailant," that's Hennessy, "fell. I was a bit dizzied from the blow to my head but got up and picked up my rifle," end quote. The other two poor Trecastle fellows, as McAvoy and Dunn, could do nothing now as they were faced with two soldiers firing down Friary Street close to them. If they tried to run up and attack them, they could just as easily have been shot themselves or stabbed with the bayonets. They made a quick escape. As the ration cart flew by at speed, two of the Bennett's Bridge contingent, that's Dan Murphy and Ned Gooley, opened fire but only managed to hit one of the unfortunate mules who was pulling the ration cart, who died just up the road at the Fair Green near the jail. Private Turner hit Thomas Hennessy in the abdomen, while Lance Corporal Higgins got Darmody in the head. Just as the first shots were fired, corporation worker Thomas Dullard from Walking Street was leaving the Friary Church after his morning prayer on his way back to work. Perhaps this is a definition of wrong place, wrong time. He ran towards High Street to get away from the shooting, which was happening just in front of him as he left the chapel. Seeing him running away, Private Gay, along with some of the other privates, shot at Dullard, thinking he was one of the IRA party escaping. Dullard received an atrocious wound to the head. It was unfortunate for all the Kilkenny men that day that these soldiers, many who would have fought in the First World War, would have undertaken extensive rifle training and would have found it relatively easy to hit their targets at such a close range on Friary Street. Seeing and hearing what was happening, O'Brien had to abort his mission. All the IRA quickly left their positions and left the city before the searches would begin. A Capuchin friar, Father Parfick, was allowed to come out to give the lads rites to the three injured men. Tom Hennessy died within seconds on Friary Street, the bullet having passed through his abdomen with an exit wound in his left buttock, which severed a major artery. The badly injured Michael Darmody was lying on his back with his head pointing towards High Street. He was unconscious but still breathing with a bullet wound to the skull. The unfortunate Thomas Dullard also had a nasty head wound. Dr. John Mitchell, whose surgery was on Friary Street, came out and bandaged up the wounded as best he could. He received a rifle butt to the head for his trouble, which left a scar for life, as the Devons initially thought he was an IRA man. The three men were brought to the military barracks by military ambulance. Dullard died there an hour later. Coincidentally, the resident of a house at the corner of where Friary Street meets Garden Row was Constable James Gray of the RIC Police on Parliament Street. That morning at 9:15 a.m. he had noticed, looking from his bedroom window, three men standing at the corner of the Friary Chapel. He said they looked uneasy and were shifting about. He actually thought they might be there to shoot him, and so he took note of them. He was afterwards able to identify the two men as Darmody and Hennessy. He had even seen them go inside the Friary Chapel for a quick prayer prior to the ambush. A journalist from the Kilkenny Moderator newspaper later described the events leading up to the civilian Thomas Dullard's death. Poor Dullard, when passing, went into the Friary Church for a moment, as was his custom whenever he went up that way. He had just come out when firing commenced. Naturally, he became frightened and commenced to run. The first house that was open to him, in which the poor fellow could have sought safety, was Alderman John Slater's house, but within only a couple of paces from the door, he fell mortally wounded, a large portion of his skull having been blown away. A downpipe on the wall at that spot where he fell was pierced by a bullet, and a window sash in Mr. O'Reilly's house also bears the marks of a bullet. Another civilian who was his status was on the street at the same time, rushed inside a small shop on the opposite side and escaped without hurt, end quote. Later that day, the dreaded auxiliaries from Inistigue arrived in Kilkenny. They set up a cordon and began searching with the help of bloodhounds. Aside from arresting some young men, they left later that evening. Lucky for the locals, the town was left intact. It was noted locally that the Devonshire Regiment soldiers did not do their usual patrols around the city in the days after the Friary Street events due to the civilian population being very much perturbed over the affair, and they were also worried that the soldiers could suffer some form of backlash or retaliation from the public. For the people of Kilkenny, it was easy to see where the three men had fallen, as their blood still stained the streets in the days afterwards. Tim Hennessy, the OC of the Kilkenny 1st Battalion, who was one of the planners of the ambush, paid a high price even though he wasn't physically present that day. You may have noticed that he has the same surname as one of the deceased IRA men. It was his own brother, Thomas Hennessy, aged 31 years, who lost his life that day. Thomas was an intelligent young man and the previous June had been elected as a councillor to the Kilkenny Urban Council and the Board of Guardians for Sinn Féin. Another Hennessy brother, John, was required to go claim his body at the barracks the day after the ambush. He told the military he last saw his brother at 7:45 a.m. the previous morning at their home in Killary, Three Castles. While in the barracks, he was allowed to visit Michael Darmody, who lay critically injured, and he was able to confirm his identity. Another of Thomas Hennessy's brothers, Father Nicholas Hennessy, said his funeral mass on Thursday morning, the 24th of February 1921, in Tullagh Church in Three Castles. During the mass, the military, who had come from Kilkenny, surrounded the church, and they removed the tricolour flag from the coffin as it left the church. Ned Dunn and Dick McAvoy, who must have been racked with guilt as they watched helplessly at close quarters, witnessing their comrades being shot, were two of the coffin bearers. Tim Hennessy, who insisted on attending the funeral to pay his respects to his brother, even though he knew he was a wanted man, was arrested when he came out of the church. He would spend nearly a year afterwards in prison without charge until he was released when the treaty was signed. Michael Darmody, who was aged 25 years, died 11 days after the attack. He never regained consciousness. He had lived with his parents, John and Catherine, his two brothers and three young nieces and nephews at the family farm in Ballydaniel, Three Castles. John later received £75, that's roughly about €7,000 in today's money, in compensation from the fledgling state for the death of his son, which had been increased from £50 on appeal. Michael Darmody had been due to travel to America with his girlfriend. No compensation was given for the death of Hennessy, as both his parents were already deceased. His father, Patrick, died in 1916, aged 87. His mother died in 1919, aged 68. His sister did try to claim compensation in the 1950s, but this was refused on the grounds that Bridges, his sister, was not dependent on him when he died. The two fallen young men were buried side by side in Tullagh Cemetery, Three Castles. In the official statement released by the Crown Forces in the aftermath of the Friary Street altercation, they maintained it was a bullet that ricocheted off the wall that accidentally killed 37-year-old Thomas Dullard. He would have been mightily unlucky to get hit with the ricocheted bullets, as this was extremely hard to do. It was an excuse often employed by the Crown Forces throughout the War of Independence when an innocent civilian was killed by their personnel. On Tuesday morning, the 22nd of February 1921, less than 24 hours after her husband's death, Bridget Dullard, née Nolan, was required to give evidence in the barracks at the private military inquiry. Bridges and Thomas had five children, ranging in age from 6 months to 15 years. These were Bridges, aged 15, Stacia, aged 11, Case, aged 5, Nicholas, aged 2, and Thomas, aged 6 months. The couple had also lost two babies in infancy in previous years. Bridget's mother, Thomas's mother-in-law, lived on Pellyfeather Lane beside the friary, not 50 yards from where he lay dying. It has only since been the release of the secret military inquiries from the British archives after nearly 100 years that we can see the soldiers who are all named in the report admitting to the inquiry they fired purposefully at Dullard. Private Gay was the only one to admit specifically that he had fired at Dullard, although he said others had fired too. Hawthorne and Higgins did not say they had fired at Dullard. And thus, it is likely that Gay, or perhaps another private who was not brought before the inquiry, was responsible for Dullard's shooting. At the inquiry, Bridget Dullard gave the following statement. Yesterday, at about 1:30 p.m, in consequence of information I received, I came to Kilkenny Military Barracks and saw the dead body of my husband, Thomas Dullard, at the hospital. At 9 a.m. yesterday, he had his breakfast with me at our house on Upper Walking Street and went off to his work about 9:30 a.m. I did not see him alive again. He was 37 last July. We have 5 children, the eldest a girl of 15. She is a delicate girl and lives at home and not able to work, having suffered from hip disease. My husband was in good health, and he was the sole support of me and my family. He was a loyalist and had nothing to do with Sinn Féin and never possessed any firearms. He was earning £2.05 a week from the corporation, which included 5 shillings for his work on the fire brigade. End quote. It is clear from her testimony that she had no choice but to very quickly come to terms with her husband's unexpected death and to start the fight for the livelihoods of her children. In an era before child benefits or other social protections, Bridget realised she now had no source of income whatsoever. In addition, it was a time where very few married women worked outside the home. Thus, she needed the military to take responsibility so she would be entitled to some form of financial compensation. Over the course of the next year, Bridget Dullard's case was brought before the local courts in Kilkenny on 4 occasions, but each time adjourned and eventually dismissed. She had initially requested £2,000 compensation. That's about €130,000 in today's money. Her case was brought against Kilkenny County Council. They said the responsibility was with the British government, whose army had killed her husband. Following the truce in July 1921, all the councillors and even the town clerk petitioned strongly to the Chief Secretary of Ireland, looking for some kind of relief for Bridget Dullard. In September 1921, 8 months after Thomas died, they received a reply from Lieutenant Commander Kenworthy. He stated that he had received a response from the Irish office in London and was informed that the court before which the application for the compensation was heard dismissed the case on the grounds that there was no proof of murder and that in these circumstances no grant for army funds could be sanctioned. End quote. The ricochet bullet story was likely the key to this, as it could not be said who fired it, nor did the inquiry try to find out. Kilkenny County Council's insurance company, that's Hibernian Insurance Society, also refused to pay. Bridges even tried her late husband's work insurance company, the ironically titled Patriotic Insurance Company, who also refused to pay, saying it was not their responsibility. She did, however, receive some small amounts from a charity fund set up in her husband's name. Could anything have been done to avoid the disaster of what occurred that ill-fated Monday morning in Kilkenny? It is easy to be wise after the fact and be armchair military tacticians, especially as 100 years remove. Things on that fateful morning happened, quite literally, in seconds. If Darmody and Hennessy attacked a few seconds later, when the rest of their IRA comrades were ready, it might have worked. In any case, it would have been difficult for the IRA party to attack and disarm every single soldier all at the exact same time. Perhaps they underestimated the soldiers who they thought would give up their weapons straightforwardly. The British soldiers would not have liked to suffer the embarrassment and reprimand of losing their arms without a fight. It was highly possible that at least one of the 7 soldiers would get a shot off, which could have scuppered plans and initiate a gun battle on both sides. Indeed, the no-shoot policy of the Friary Street ambush would have been generally very unusual at this final stage of the War of Independence, no matter how well-intentioned it was. In purely militaristic terms, it's a safe bet that the IRA in Cork, for instance, or even the Callan IRA closer to home, would not have initiated an ambush with a no-shoot order. On the other hand, it showed the bravery of the men taking part. They were willing to go ahead with the plans, the aim of which was to limit the loss of life, knowing they were immediately at a major disadvantage by not being ordered to fire first. The following Sunday at Masses all around Kilkenny, City and County, a message was read from the Bishop of Ossory, 84-year-old Dr. Brownrigg, lambasting the IRA for their attack in the City. He said he was speaking from the moral aspect and that I wish to declare that I cannot find words strong enough to condemn the folly and crimes of those who planned and attempted to carry out the recent attack on the military. The partisan, provocative and disastrous policy pursued by the British government in recent years affords, according to the teachings of the Catholic Church, no justification for such deeds as shocked our city last Monday. End quote. In other words, he was saying, no matter how bad the British are, you still can't ambush them. During the 1930s, a committee was formed and spearheaded by Jim Lawler, the former Kilkenny Brigade Vice OC, which collected money and erected a plaque on the corner of Pennyfeather Lane, just at the spot on Friary Street where their former comrades fell, which can still be seen there today. The memorial remembers the two fallen IRA men and not the civilian fatality of the Friary Street ambush. This is often the case of wars more generally around the world, where civilians are often forgotten. Those who die in the line of duty fighting for the cause are considered to take precedent. Although the Crown Forces privately admitted responsibility for shooting dead of Dullard, publicly they did not, with one of the findings of the inquiry stating that the said deceased Thomas Dullard was himself to blame inasmuch as he ran away from the scene of an ambush. It is difficult to understand how else they expected a person to react when suddenly faced with an ambush situation, running hastily being the most obvious response. That concludes this podcast on Friary Street. I hope you enjoyed it. Join me again next time where we'll be talking about the Gary Ricken House shoes house. Thanks again for listening. Goodbye.